More and more over time, people are making clear how they want their medical care, or lack of it, to be handled as the end of life approaches. It's no fun thinking about death and planning for it, but making wishes known in advance can make a big difference in what happens. The Rogue Valley organization COHO, Choosing Options, Honoring Options, is all about letting people know what choices they have as the end of life approaches. And COHO will host a community forum on the role religious and spiritual beliefs play in the process. That'll be February 19th at the Smullen Center in Medford. It'll be moderated by Episcopal priest Father Joel Majorano, who's in the studio with us here. Father Joel, welcome.
Thank you.
Rabbi Joshua Bodiger is here with us as well from Temple of Mechshalom in Ashland as well. And Priscilla Weaver is here from COHO. Priscilla, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And why don't we start with you and tell us a bit about COHO and how it got started in the first place.
COHO is a group of individuals, lots of volunteers, lots of organizations in the Valley that came together first about 5 years ago because there was the sense that we needed here in the Rogue Valley to do a better job of talking with our families, our friends, and our medical providers about how we want to be treated in all respects, medically treated, emotionally treated, spiritually treated, as we come toward the end of life, either because we're old or because we have a serious illness or whatever. So the choosing part of COHO is having those conversations and then putting them in writing in some formal documents. The honoring part, then, is the ongoing effort to keep our families advised of what we want and to keep talking to our medical providers about how we want to be treated at the end of life. So that's what COHO is.
And was there just a lack of organizations that had a similar focus? Was there just some particular niche you were looking to carve out there?
Well, it's an issue for everyone, not just in the Rogue Valley, of course. But we have a particularly committed medical community here, I think, and especially a very well-known cardiologist, John Forsyth. And he really was the founder and the guiding light that got it started and continues today to be very important. And I think it's fair to say he and other people in the medical community sensed that it needed to happen.
So it's one thing to get the legal ducks in a row and the medical powers lined up, but have there been issues with conflicts between what people's choices are and what that says within their religious traditions?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I assume there are conflicts all the time about what happens with people at the end of life, or we wouldn't be sitting here this morning. I mean, that's a flip way to answer, but I think my colleagues here are better able to answer that question.
All right. Let's start with Father Rabbi Joshua Bodiger. Tell us about whether there are situations where what a person wants for their care or withholding of care at the end of life might come into conflict with Judaism.
Well, there's, and we'll speak more to just the cultural barriers as far as the difficulty of starting conversations and what we inherit societally, regardless of our religious tradition. But a lot of people who have grown up in the Jewish tradition, in the Jewish faith, have this sense that according to Jewish law, one is not able to do anything that would end their life. And we can talk about it's kind of a broad term and it can mean different things before it's natural, before that natural process unfolds. So there's a lot of ambivalence about, am I allowed to choose to stop having medical treatment at a certain point? Does that go against Judaism? Am I supposed to fight for life every moment of the way until there's absolutely no hope? And only then can I let myself go? So I'm happy to speak more to that, but I think that's the main issue that Jews run up against.
And it's interesting. So, you, as the Episcopalian priest here, Father Joel Majorano, you get to moderate too, huh?
Yeah. That means I get to pick on my other clergy and ask them the tough questions.
So, within the Episcopalian tradition, are there any issues there where you got conflicts with end of life wishes versus what the tenets of the religion are?
That's a tough question to answer.
Everybody said the same thing so far.
Because the Episcopal Church is quite a bit on the spectrum, rather large, and so is all of Christianity. I married a Quaker. I grew up Catholic. I was a minister in the Church of Christ. So I speak from a hodgepodge of experiences, and that's the actual I should say the story most people come to when they're in the hospital or when they have to make tough choices. Each of us approach life from a philosophy or even a theology as we set or write our narrative. And so whatever our story is heavily influenced by our experiences. And so people come in with their own experiences. Now, sometimes the narrative, if it's influenced by a theological premise, then the question begins to be asked, is this going to be a problem and how? And most of the time, you know, death is a medical, but it's purely a personal issue as well. So with that come a Madrid of challenges that people bring in. And sometimes we die like we live. And if we live tough and fragmented, like most of us, we're going to die fragmented.
Priscilla Weaver, I'm curious to know about the growth of people who have taken things, steps like advanced directives to make it clear what their wishes are at the end of life, whether you're noticing an uptick in people filing those forms.
Well, there's been a dramatic increase in the Rogue Valley. That can be measured in two ways. There are formal statistics on it that the state keeps because of the forms called POLST forms, P-O-L-S-T. There are records of those. COHO has had several thousand, I believe, people now attend their seminar series each year, not each year, but over the last 4 years. And a significant number of those use this series and especially the workshop at the end to go ahead and fill out their own forms. So I think we probably have a much higher proportion of people in the Rogue Valley than in many other communities who have the documents and then have also had the conversations that are so important.
Okay, we'll pick it up on the other side of a break. We're discussing the end of life and our approach to it and religious traditions rolled in there as well. We'll come back and talk more with Priscilla Weaver, Father Majorano, and Rabbi Bodiger when we return to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the end of life and rolling religious and spiritual traditions in there as well. This all begins with a forum that COHO, the Rogue Valley Group Choosing Options, Honoring Options, will be hosting on February 19th. About that very subject matter, Priscilla Weaver from COHO is here with us, as is the moderator of that forum, Father Joel Majorano, who's Episcopalian. Rabbi Joshua Bodiger is here as well from Temple Emek Shalom in Ashland. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about making choices for the end of life and how your religious and spiritual beliefs roll into that. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area, 800-838-3760. Or by email, jx@jeffnet.org, or check out our Facebook page, and you can see pictures of our guests as we sat down to business just a few minutes ago. And yes, it was really fun to be able to say a priest and a rabbi walk into a radio studio, because we don't often get that kind of a setup. However, a fairly, you know, so there's a lighthearted approach in the room, but the fact is it is a subject people don't like to talk about very much, Priscilla. Is this a major barrier that people in COHO and just in society generally have to overcome just to get to talk about it?
It is. When we chose the title for the series this year, we entitled it Facing Mortality, the Elephant in the Room. It is very difficult. Many people my age, and I'm 68, find that their adult children don't want to talk about it. They say, oh, Mom, not now. And, of course, the reverse is true, that they adult children want their parents to make plans and the parents don't want to make plans. So it is the barrier.
Interesting that it is often the generation removed, once removed from facing death, that is the one that really doesn't want to talk about it. And honestly, I can remember now the same conversation with my mother where she said, you know, we need to talk about what's going to happen when I go. Oh, no, we got lots of time. Well, we didn't. She died at 74. So you get surprised from time to time.
Go ahead. I was just going to say my parents started talking to us about it when they were in their 60s and they were leaving home to go and volunteer up in Alaska. Okay, so we heard about it from my mother for 30 years. And so when she died, it wasn't difficult. She died a wonderful death, in part because all of us knew what she wanted. And we didn't waste time bickering about how she should die.
In a sense, you'd rehearsed it, at least in your minds. You went over the steps anyway.
over and over again.
Over again for 30 years. Father Majorano, you were going to come in there?
Yeah, I was just going to say that we do live in a death-denying culture in a sense. Recently, I'm working with a number of residents. My full-time job is up at Rogue Valley Manor as the Director of Pastoral Services, and I'm working with residents on setting up a memorial. And one of the residents, who happens to be a member of Rabbi's congregation, said, I came up here because I wanted to think about life, not about death. And so a memorial represented to him death, and he didn't want to have to think about that. It makes me think about an experience I had last night. Just to take a moment, our cat passed away last night.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I am too, for many reasons, and I'll share them now. But my son, I have two sons, Gian and Michael, 6 and 10, and my wife. And as I was spending time with them, listening to them cry uncontrollably, I heard my son Gian, who's 6, say, you know, I loved Zoe. I love Zoe. And past and present tense, and it was a liminal space. In grief, oftentimes, and grief, thinking about processing the dying process, puts us in that liminal space. We're there, but we're not yet there. And then, for me, I kept thinking about, I've got to get back to work. Until I picked up the cat, we buried him in my backyard. Until I picked up the cat, and my Jewish brother here taught me. A very interesting concept, Kavanah, with his intention. And until I picked up Zoe and felt Zoe and petted Zoe in a lifeless state, did all the memories of Zoe come back? Not only of Zoe, and I was very close to the cat, but all the cats that I had and all the experiences going back as a young child and having Andrew and Andrew Jackson and Thomasina and all the different cats and their influences in my life. And so that intention, that Kavanah, being present to the moment, I think is really important.
So we have a call here. Let's grab some headphones, and we'll get Steve and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about life, death, and religion with Father Joel Majorano, Rabbi Joshua Bodiger, and Priscilla Weaver. Hi, Steve.
Howdy. When hospice people or religious people are talking about end of life and how to approach it and so on, generally, the one subject that is either ignored or considered taboo is the Death with Dignity Act. And I think this is, you know, a real important option that Oregonians have and should be discussed more. Should be discussed why your religion is against offing yourself if you don't want to keep racking up medical bills, if you're in pain, if the quality of your life does not, you know, equal the quantity of your life, or you want to stop it yourself and just say enough is enough. And I'd like your reaction to that.
All right, Death with Dignity Law. Thanks for that, Steve. Always good to talk to you. Rabbi Bodiger, you want to come in here first?
Sure. Well, first of all, I should say, just personally speaking, I think I'm grateful to live in a state with this law. That said, there are a lot of complexities as far as what I named at the outset, which is a sense that according to halakha or Jewish law, one isn't technically allowed to end their life in a way that, you know, one would be able to under the law. And of course, the law covers, and what Father Joel was saying originally is that there's, you know, when we talk about death, there's something that's so personal, obviously, to each individual in each case. So we have to be wary of speaking in generalities. But that said, my grandmother decided to end her life she decided about 10 years ago to stop eating and drinking. And she's really been my teacher in this regard. And there's a sense that even if what my grandmother did wasn't allowed according to the letter of the law, in Judaism. There's a lot of Jewish values that one could hold up that would be in dialogue, that would, you know, be part of the dialogue and the conversation. And there's also a particular stipulation in Jewish law that says one's allowed to remove the obstacles or the impediments that might keep one from dying if otherwise they would. So there's actually a lot of room for exploration, and I think for rabbis, for caregivers, anyone coming from a Jewish tradition, and again, I'm speaking in kind of specific language of Jewish law, but this would go, I think, with any situation where someone was a pastor or sitting with someone who was facing those choices, the first commandment, as it were, is just to listen, to really learn where this particular person is, what's important to them. And often we get a lay of the land and we're able to call on different aspects in our religious tradition to help make those choices. But I'm glad to live in a state, to go back to the caller's initial question, where we have these options.
End-of-life care and religious and spiritual traditions are the topic here on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Rabbi Joshua Bodiger, from Temple Emek Shalom, Father Joel Majorano, who is Episcopalian and is the head of pastoral services at the Rogue Valley Manor, and Priscilla Weaver from Coho, Choosing Options, Honoring Options, which is putting these gentlemen together in a room with several other religious leaders on February 19th to talk about this very topic. You can talk about it here and now on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I'm glad Steve brought this up because it gives us a place from which to walk then, because if we're not talking about actively ending life, we are talking about perhaps passively ending it, as I believe your grandmother did from the sounds of it, Rabbi. And so what issues may crop up within certain religious traditions when the person says, I don't want heroic means to save my life. I don't want medication or a procedure that would keep me alive for another week or month or 6 months or something like that. And so, Priscilla, I throw it back to you to see if anybody's ever gotten into the zone with when they just fill out the advance directive, for example.
Well, two things. One is we pretty clearly identified a topic that I hope these two gentlemen will address in the panel on February 19th. It's a really good reason to attend. And what I was thinking when Rabbi Bodiger was speaking is that I too am glad to live where we have these choices. There are conversations, I know they've happened to at least two people in my family, where the subject of hastening your demise, hastening your death one way or the other, comes up. Whether that results in someone taking advantage of the law or not, or stopping to eat, having the conversations about those issues are exactly the kind of thing that can enrich the experience of dying and make it an important part of our lives, not just death. So yes, it comes up all the time, I assume. It certainly did in my family.
That's a very tough question, and I'm glad you started off with the rabbi, because, you know.
He got it first.
Yeah, he did. He did get it first, but I'll go the more theoretical route. You know, there's many variables. For the spiritual or religious person, we have our narrative, the story that we continue to tell ourselves, and it runs against a meta-narrative or a master narrative, the story in which we believe to be holy or to be true. And when that hits up against the meta-narrative, then we have some questions that need to be answered. And too often, we come to the sanctity of life with a word that we call choice. But the things that go into choice are very important. I think what clergy do is help people look at their values coming into a life or death situation and ask those questions. You need to examine those variables. What do you believe about God? Where do you believe God is in the midst of this situation? And how are you responding, or how are you feeling towards the experience you're about to have? And so as a clergy member, I try to stay away from absolutes in a sense, especially when I'm working with families, and try to walk with them and ask them key questions. And also, just as Rabbi said, be the ministry of presence.
I noticed that the actual title for the discussion on the 19th is, and I should point out, this is at the Smullen Center on the Rogue Regional Medical Center campus on Barnett Road in Medford. And you have two sessions, is that right? Each of these will be two?
Yes, we offer it both in the afternoon and evening so we can accommodate people at work and people that can't attend during the day.
Okay, two in the afternoon for this session on looking at the life cycle with different spiritual tradition, and seven in the evening. So how big a deal in either tradition that is represented in this room is made of death from the perspective of when it approaches? Are both religions, I don't think, volumes of material on this, or are they both somewhat silent about how to deal with it? Of course, this is when they point at each other like, no, you take it.
You know, I hope to grow up. I mean, I hope to grow up and be a rabbi, a little bit better looking and a lot smarter than the one next to me, but not as generous in offering me the questions. You had the last hard one, so I'll take this one. Well, I would quote Walter Brueggemann, who's a Old Testament theologian who comes to the Psalms, and he says, oftentimes we read the Psalms, we have orientation, we have disorientation, and then we have reorientation, and that often is what happens with grief, loss, and death. From the Christian perspective, the narrative in which I personally hold is death, burial, and resurrection. So I believe in the metaphor of resurrection, not only in my own personal experiences and challenges, but in the death narrative. And so as much as I hold that to heart, I often don't talk about it because I see it used in my tradition as escapism from embracing the pain. And you'll never hear me say, well, God needed your son more than you did, or that he's in a better place now, or that, well, he's living into his reward. I think that oftentimes will create an escapism between the pain and the natural loss one feels when someone they cared about passes.
In Judaism, we have there's a famous verse in the Torah that says "Uvecharta b'chaim," familiar to Jews and Christians and others of faith. You will choose life, right? The sense of choosing life, and that being the commandment that overrides all other commandments. And yet, even if we live our life with in relationship to that verse, we run the risk, especially in the age that we live in, where we're able to prolong life, by heroic measures in some cases for a long, long time, we run the risk of making life itself into an idol almost. And there's a sense in Judaism that death is not the end of life. It's a part of life. The rabbi then, or the pastor, or the family members, whoever is sitting with the person who is dying, is a midwife in the process of that dying. So there's as Father Joel was just speaking about, our tradition, we we've been trying to name, in a politic way, our traditions, despite their best intentions, will throw up roadblocks sometimes in the form of the language that we're used to. But I think there's really an invitation when you sit with the text, when you sit with the traditions, to turn towards the sanctity of what this process, the dying process, can look like. And we're invited into ever deeper relationships with one another.
Let us take some more calls. We have Jamie in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rabbi Joshua Bodiger, Father Joel Majorano, and Priscilla Weaver.
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, people.
Howdy.
Well, I just wanted to point out something that's existing here in the state. It's something called Oregon Health Decisions. There's a toll-free number you can call about that, and there's a website regarding that. But basically, what it is it's able to document what you think, what you want to do when you're in a position where you cannot decide for yourself. It's something that's documented that will make the decisions for you. And if I could give the toll-free number out for that.
Go ahead.
1-800-422-4805. There's a website, but basically you can get started about that. And basically it just comes down to some key conversations that you have with your family and your friends about what happens to you when you're unable to decide for yourself about your mortality. And Jeffrey, if I could ask the rabbi, sir, it's my understanding that I believe the Jewish people don't believe that there is an afterlife, and if that's not so, I would like to have your take on that off the air, if I could, Jeffrey. So.
All right. Thanks for that, Jamie. Appreciate that.
This, if folks were raised Jewish in the last 60 years in North America and you asked them that question, I would imagine that 90% of people would say, yeah, that we don't, but Judaism believes in the here and now. Right? We don't believe in an afterlife. I think there's two reasons for that. One is I think we're living still in the horrible shadow of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, and that was another reason that we didn't talk about death as often as we could, that it became more of a taboo subject, perhaps. But while there is no heaven and hell, there is no, you know, specific relationship to heaven and hell, there are, it's actually funny, I have a book on my shelf called Jewish Views of the Afterlife, which is better, you know, I would say paperweight, but I'm trying to think of something even bigger than that. It's probably the biggest book I have in my bookshelf. And it really tells you that there's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different opinions that have been given about what happens to the soul after they die, after it dies in Judaism, after the body dies. But the one common thread is that there is life after death, that the soul continues. And that's something that a lot of Jews themselves aren't aware of, that we have this this openness to the afterlife in our tradition.
We have a whole lot more to talk about. We'll take a short break and come back with Rabbi Bodiger, Father Majorano, and Priscilla Weaver and talk more about end-of-life care and religious traditions when we return to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Nothing big talking about here today, just the end of life and religion. A few couple of subjects and how they intersect. We're talking about this because COHO, the Medford-based group, Choosing Options, Honoring Options, is hosting a discussion about this coming up on February 19th, looking at the life cycle with different spiritual traditions. That's at the Rogue Regional Medical Center campus, the Smullen Center, 2 in the afternoon and 7 in the evening on February 19th. Father Joel Majorano is an Episcopalian, and he's also the director of pastoral services at the Rogue Valley Manor, and he'll be the moderator. Rabbi Joshua Bodiger from the Temple of Mech Shalom in Ashland will be another one of the participants, and Priscilla Weaver from COHO is largely involved in putting all this together. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about end of life and religion, and certainly the many, many intersecting points there. 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org, or check out the picture of our guests on our Facebook page. Jamie called a minute ago to talk about Oregon Health Decisions, which is at OregonHealthDecisions.org, and he gave the toll-free number. We'll provide a link to that on the topic listing for this segment on our website and therefore on Facebook as well. Let's take another call. Here's Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, very quickly. It's all something that I've pondered about for years. Every time we turn around, every government official, courts, whatever, this is a Christian nation. It's just so drummed into our brains since we were kids. I can imagine being an Ogallala Sioux or anything else. Anyway, one thing that's very important for people to realize and remember, have a medical power of attorney and include in that any at end-of-life decisions, and make sure family members, if possible, there is a family physician that you know, has been aiding the older man or woman, so they all kind of know where they stand. And that's what's kind of missing. Doctors are kind of left, you know, holding up thin air. Yeah, and that's so important. But just the concept of this is a Christian nation is just so drummed into everybody's head that I just wonder how much of an influence that has on everything.
Huh. Interesting question in that respect. Thanks for that, Jim. Appreciate it. And so, Priscilla, set us straight, because we hear medical power of attorney. We hear advanced directives, ADs. You mentioned Pulse, the physician orders for life-sustaining treatment. So there's a fair number of things to weed out here. What are some of the basics that people need to know?
In Oregon, the advanced directive includes a medical health care representative section, and it's really critical to think hard about who you want to have be your health care representative. There are some defaults. If you don't name someone, your spouse is a default. I'm pretty sure your children are. But even more important is the backup healthcare representative so that if, for example, if my husband and I were in a car accident and neither one of us could speak for a while, who would be our backup? That's very important. So the advanced care directive will include the healthcare representative. Once you fill it out, it's critical that you provide copies to your doctors. They should be on file with the hospitals. They obviously need to be with whoever your healthcare representatives are. They don't do anybody any good if they're in a drawer. The POLST form, which is Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, is a medical form in this sense. It's something you talk to your doctor about. You typically do those toward the end of life if you're old or if you have a serious illness. Once you fill that out, and it's basically do not resuscitate if you don't want to be resuscitated, if you have a heart attack or whatever when you're very old. But it's a legal document. It's filed with the state, and it's the hospitals have access to them. So that if you get taken in a ambulance to the hospital or the EMT shows up at your house, and you have your bright pink POLST form there, they know whether you want to be resuscitated. That's a simplistic answer, but that's the difference between the forms.
Let me just add a little emotion to that. Oftentimes, as a former hospice and hospital chaplain, working with families who had advanced directives or medical powers attorneys, it was easy to remind them what their parent, what their loved one, what their child may have wanted. And so you're honoring the decision of that family member.
That's right. The medical healthcare representative is supposed to be your voice. So in a sense, they're not making decisions for you. They're carrying out the decisions that you would want to be made. That's why it's important to choose somebody to be your healthcare representative who will honor your wishes. And that's where a lot of the tension comes in having the conversations, is when the person who's filling out the form and expressing their wishes is having difficulty persuading family members or friends to honor their wishes. That's the importance of the forms. The forms speak for you, and so does your healthcare representative.
Which brings up two questions. Number one, you probably want to make sure you have the person fully on board as you're filling out the forms, I would think.
Absolutely.
And then what happens if you have not identified or you have gone through the entire bench of backups and the person who is now having to function as your healthcare representative, you know, maybe a second cousin's daughter or something, and says, "No, I don't want to let her go," or something contrary to what the advance directive calls for.
It's not a perfect system, and sometimes they don't work, but they're so much better than not having anything at all, because by not having an advance care directive and by not having a healthcare representative, you are choosing to let strangers make those decisions for you in hospitals.
Usually it's the medical physician or
that's right.
caregivers right. with input from the family, but it's the doctor.
And the default is that you'll get full treatment, you'll be resuscitated, you'll be put on a ventilator, even if you didn't want to be. You'll get tube feeding and the whole nine yards. That's the default, of course, is full treatment.
Because in the absence of any particular directive to do otherwise, the obligation of the medical staff is to make sure that you're still there with us.
That's correct.
And so I wonder, I noticed that you're nodding a bit at this conversation as we went through it, Rabbi Bodiger, if people have discussions with you before they fill out the forms.
They definitely do, and I really welcome that, and I know all you know, pastors and clergy welcome that conversation. One of the things that was drummed into us in seminary was, if you're ever working with someone near the end of life, you're working with the whole family. So it's wonderful to have people come in and to begin that process, to come into my office. And that's also a way that I can connect them to Coho and other professionals who can be, I think, even more effective than I can be. But as a way to begin that conversation, and then even better, the next steps to have some kind of mediation as far as having the whole family in the room. And sometimes when there's a third party, it can be easier to have difficult conversations that would have been non-navigatable if it was just the adult children, say, and their parent.
I'm going to ask of any of the three of you in the room, if you've gotten into situations where people said, "I don't need to fill out an advance directive because my kids know me and they know what I want," and they've been wrong.
I would love to answer that.
Go ahead.
And this is a plug for the seminar series, plain and simple. One of the things that you'll hear about if you come to some of these seminars is a variety of tools that are available, obviously clergy, to help families who are in disagreement. The problem is, if you don't have these decisions talked about in advance, then you end up in a hospital emergency room and there's family conflict instead of directing your attention to the family. One of the best tools is something called Go Wish Cards, not Go Fish, which is interesting because of Coho. Go Wish Cards, and they help families talk about end-of-life issues. It's too long to describe them here, but it's one of the tools that you'll hear about if you come to the seminars.
It does. Can the advance directive get specific enough? I honestly don't. Haven't gotten to this point yet. Obviously, that's become quite clear.
Shame on you.
I know. Can it be as specific as, because I know people don't want to die in hospitals. Both my parents died in hospitals. I don't think either one of them wanted to be there. But can you actually say on the advance directive form, don't even transport me. I don't want to leave home if X happens. I mean, how detailed can you get?
I'm not sure about the advance directive. I know that a lot of older people and people with diseases like that are chronic and that you're not going to get better from use the POLST form, and they put it right up on their refrigerator so that if somebody calls an EMT to come out and resuscitate you, if you don't want to be resuscitated, that form says don't resuscitate me, and you won't be. I believe you won't be taken to the hospital at all. I'm not positive about that, but. The detail on the advance directive, I'm not sure it's quite that specific.
Right.
Is it?
Yes, you can. Well, the advance directives that I've filled out and helped other people fill out, yes, it is. Whether or not it's honored, it has to be present for the medical care when they arrive,
yeah.
Or they will automatically go into resuscitation mode.
It sounds like you need to have a couple of copies then hanging on the walls of your house or something. Okay.
Your glove compartment box, your wallet. Your safe deposit box, your doctor, your hospital. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Actually, the worst place you can put it is your safety deposit box because nobody will ever see it. But
I like the refrigerator.
That's right out there held on with a magnet.
Well,
for example,
sure.
My mother lived at the Manor, and I believe they are required to have them right by their front doors.
Really?
Well, but that's a place where older people live.
Sure. Yeah, so, and all that is understood. Yeah. You mentioned the POLST form. The physician orders for life-sustaining treatment are filed with hospitals. Where do the advance directives go?
Well, mine's at all the hospitals. It's with my physician. It's with my healthcare representatives. And I talk about it with the people that might want to know about it.
All right. For either of the pastoral representatives here, particularly for you, Father Majorano, because I suspect you've worked in some hospice and chaplain situations, but the questions that may come from family members as they are struggling with executing the advance directives, you get a lot of why?
Absolutely. I want to share a little, two little stories from a friend of mine named Greg Garrett. He's a literature professor at Baylor, but he wrote a book called A Theology of Grief, and he says, Barbara Brown Taylor says, about the process of disillusionment. And that's what we're talking about oftentimes when we think about death or having to fill out forms that make us think about things that we don't want to think about. And he said, and disillusionment makes clear what's essential to the authentic spiritual life. And she writes, if God does not come when I call, she says, then it must mean that God is not a collie. If God doesn't fulfill my wishes, then it must mean God's not a genie. The disillusionment and disappointment we face when we realize we have been wrong about God or life may be painful, but it forces us to evaluate our conceptions of God or life or the dying process. And then he goes on to say, remember that any conception we create, however well thought out or faithfully followed, is still just a box in which we carry our understanding of life or death. And so if you believe that God wipe away every tear and yet you're still crying, then maybe your box is broken, not your faith. And if you believe that God will heal your mother, if you only pray hard enough and yet it still suffers, then perhaps your box is broken, not your prayer life. And so oftentimes families come into the conversation and it's a little fear on both sides. The father and mother, the child is struggling with how to communicate with their family, their wishes, and don't know exactly whether or not their family members value or will uphold their wishes. And then the children who really want to have a conversation don't necessarily, and going back to rabbis, question is clergy, we midwife. We mediate, and sometimes we provide opportunities for people to talk.
Just in people broaching the subject, Rabbi, of death in general, is there a sense of squeamishness? Does anybody just come and go, okay, I want to talk about my death and you know, approach it in a warm and positive way? Or is it often kind of a, let's tiptoe into this kind of thing?
By the time they're in my office, usually they've you know, asked for an appointment and they're ready to talk about it. So, you know, we have this term in our society these days, a good death. And I think as we get more information, which is wonderful, and more options, we somehow think that, well, we can control this. We can somehow, and I think that's the risk of using that term, a good death. I think ultimately, you know, we all stand before this great mystery. None of us knows what's going to happen, either after we die or in the process of dying. There's going to be so many things we can't control. We can be informed, which helps. We can have conversations, which help, that are hard conversations to have. But ultimately, there's a sense that one of our prayers is just, look, we're going to do the best we can. We're going to love each other. We're going to have humility before this process. We're going to try to listen best we can. And then, you know, there's no such thing as a good death. It's going to be specific for each of us in that regard. But it's good to live in a time, as we began the program with, where we do have more options.
Fred. Rabbi Bodiger, and we're getting out of time here. Father Majorana will be part of the panel as they talk about looking at the life cycle with different spiritual traditions. February 19th at Rogue Regional Medical Center. Can you give us 30 seconds and talk about the rest of the series? I know you wanted to get some in there.
I do. On February 26th, also a Thursday, we will have a veteran actor from who used to be at Shakespeare, Megan Cole, will be presenting her own one-act play about dealing with the white-hot crucible of serious illness. On March 12th, we'll have three physicians talking about different levels of care, full care, palliative care, hospice. On March 19th, we'll have a brand new play by local playwright Peter Quince and some Shakespeare actors about having difficult conversations. And then on April 16th, which is National Healthcare Decisions Day, there'll be a workshop for doing advanced care directives.
Great. Thank you all for joining us today, Father, Rabbi, and Priscilla. Good to have you all in the Jefferson Exchange.